Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. It's Thursday. That means open forum. Any question you've got about the Catholic Church is welcome today, and you don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-31-TRUTH is the number, 888-318-7884. If you've got something that's been sticking in your craw, or it's been you haven't worked out the answer for yourself yet, having to do with the Catholic Church, that's welcome. If there's maybe someone else that you need to help, a child or relative in the family has a question that you have not been able to answer, that is welcome. Or maybe you're just curious about us Catholics and what we believe. 888-318-7884. You can be Catholic, you can be non-Catholic. Anybody can call. Our guest this hour is the author of The Drama of Salvation, and he's the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, how's it going? I have a question for you.
Okay, yes.
So you said you invited people to call in if they had something stuck in their craw.
Okay.
What is a craw?
That is if you have a crawdad, then that's the baby of the crawdad. No.
No.
Okay, what's a craw, Jimmy? I don't know. They just used the expression. I realize I don't even know. I always thought it was a bird's beak.
But it has two meanings, and one of them is connected with birds or insects.
Okay.
In that case, it's their crop, which
on
is
the top of
on the top of their head. But in a land animal, it's a stomach.
Oh, really?
So, and that's the usage for if you have something stuck in your craw, meaning you got something burning in your gut that you just want to get out, you can ask a question.
Oh, wow. One of those – I've used it a million times that I've never even thought about what it means. Wow.
Yeah, cool.
So that, well, I'm glad you got that out of your craw there, Jimmy Akin. 888
– And off my back.
I know what that one means. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. I mentioned that you're the author of The Drama of Salvation, but what I probably should have been touting was this DVD, The Dawn of Christian History, Unveiling the Story of the Early Church. This is exciting, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
It's connected to the Book of Acts.
Right. Not just the Book of Acts, but yeah.
But that period.
Mm-hmm.
So for the period from we'll start around.
To tell you the truth, it's been a year since I gave this talk. So I forget, did I start at the beginning of Jesus' ministry or the end of it? But from the ministry of Jesus forward.
Right. And then, we have a lot of, we have a lot of information in the Bible. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of clues that we can kind of suss out from the Bible.
This is one of the things that really excites me is I love studying. I love detective stories.
Yeah.
And to me, Christian history is like a big detective story because you have all these different clues that were given in the New Testament, but then also in other places like in Roman history and Greek history and stuff. And how do they all fit together? And what can we deduce from all these different clues?
Yeah.
And it's like a big puzzle, and I love intellectual puzzles like that and figuring out stuff. And so that comes across, I hope, in this talk I gave, where I show a lot of the connections that people aren't otherwise aware of try to bring new light on passages people may be familiar with, but it's like, oh, I never saw that before.
Well, I have to say, it's something that I ask you about all the time. I'm always I just love hearing you talk about it. I really hope that shucks. Mm-hmm. I hope that the viewer, because I think you have done that thing where you have you've looked at it comprehensively enough to give a picture that, okay, that's how that fits with that. And I always enjoy getting those insights. There's some things we'll never know.
Yeah.
There's some things we can surmise. There's lots of things we can know, however. And one of the things that I find fascinating about the whole thing is that in a certain way, you're moving through history, you're getting farther and farther from these events.
Mm-hmm.
But in another way, as you're moving through history, you're getting closer and closer to them as
more data comes online.
New manuscripts are found. Oh, in some library, they found a first time, or there's new archaeology that's done.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, you can be closer to the Gospels today than you could have been, say, in the year 1000, where, mm-hmm.
yeah,
where they really didn't know the context of them.
Yep, absolutely.
So I find that fun, and it's well, you can get it now. I'll tell people where you can get it in a little while. I mean, more details about it. I think they're shipping it for free right now.
But that's right. In fact, I saw in the note today. Today's like I think the last day for free shipping.
That's crazy. So have you wanted to make it the last day?
Well, I don't.
I'm gonna try to extend that.
That sounds good. Okay. But in case I isn't able to, if you want to get it with free shipping, today's the day.
You know all the power I have around here, Jim.
go to shop.catholic.com or give us a call, 888-291-8000, and they'll be more than happy to hook you up with the Dawn of Christian History DVD.
Yeah, and you will not regret it. I can tell you, you will not regret it. 888-318-7884 is our number here. We're taking any questions. You know, the other thing, when Jimmy's here, we're pretty broad in our definition of Catholic. You know, if you want to know some, if you have a philosophical question.
It doesn't have to be Catholic.
That is very broad.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Catholic means universal.
Yeah.
So,
okay, there you go.
So it's even more Catholic.
Even more Catholic. I'll take that.
All right. So 888-318-7884, the number, 888-318-7884. A ton of callers already, Jimmy. Shall we?
Yeah.
All right. Jose in New Jersey, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Start us off with a question, Jose.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
Okay. So my question for you guys is, if the debate I have within myself, and I feel like this has been a debate that's been going on ever since, you know, after Vatican II and stuff like this. So I went on vacation and I was able to visit a parish, and for the first time I saw people receiving communion kneeling and on the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
I was so touched by it. I almost cried to see this happen, because what a way, you know, what there was so much reverence towards, you know, the Blessed Sacrament,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I went back and I kind of told some people in my parish, and I found out that it's kind of like frowned upon to be able to receive kneeling.
Who told you
that?
So
my question, one of the people from the parish, he used to do it before, and so the pastor that was there kind of said something about it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
He didn't really give me specifics,
okay.
but that's what went on, right? So my question is, is it wrong for me to, like, receive in that way if the community receives in one way? Like,
nope.
What it do
is,
you guys think?
This is totally up to you. Now, to give you a little bit of the backstory on this, there was a movement here in the United States to tell people that they need to receive standing and on the tongue. They're not supposed – or standing and in the hand. They're not supposed to receive kneeling or on the tongue. Even though that for hundreds of years was the historic way to do it in the Latin Rite, and even though a lot of people still wanted to do it that way. But there was this movement in some liturgical circles to say, nope, we're supposed to do it this new way. And the Holy See didn't agree. And so there was some kind of back and forth on that. And for a time, the way the rules were written for the United States was the rules said, and this was in a document known as the General Instruction of the Roman Missal, or the GIRM, G-I-R-M. In the General Instruction, the rules for a while said that if somebody wants to receive kneeling, then the minister of communion should not stop them, but should explain the reasons for the norm of standing privately. And so that allowed people to receive kneeling, but it also allowed the minister of communion, an ordinary minister like a priest or an extraordinary minister, to explain to the person privately what the reasons were for standing. Well, basically, there were no reasons in particular for standing. It's a matter of personal preference. There's no liturgical reason why you need to do it one way or another. And eventually, the Holy See got tired of people being browbeat about this, because people who wanted to go receive kneeling would go and kneel, and then they'd get a lecture afterwards about it. And the Holy See put a stop to that. And so when the new edition of the GIRM came out in 2010, it was revised again to just say that it's up to the individual. So it's purely up to you. The church does not have a preference on this. So if you find that receiving communion kneeling fosters your spirituality, then go ahead and kneel. Now, you might get a little bit of pushback on that. You might get kind of a funny look or something like that from somebody. But frankly, who cares? Do not be a slave to peer pressure. Don't be a jerk either. You know, don't look down on people who prefer to receive standing. That's their option too. So this is a situation where the Holy See has left it up to individuals. How do they want to receive? Whatever better fosters your devotion, whether that's receiving standing or receiving kneeling, feel free to go ahead and do that. And respect other people's right to choose their way of doing it, whether it's the same as yours or not.
How's that, Jose?
That's great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate that call, Jose. It kind of brings up a question I've always wanted to ask, and I keep forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
What's the rules on the altar rail? Because when I was a kid, we had an altar rail in the parish. I really liked it,
mm-hmm.
but is that also permitted or no?
Altar rails are permitted, but they are not mandated. And
okay.
the way that most parishes are configured now, they're not practical.
Yeah.
And it's for a variety of reasons. In some parishes, for example, like in my parish, St. Anonymous the Ambiguous.
That is not your parish.
Sure it is. It's how I refer to my parish in public. There's no space for an altar rail. The sanctuary comes out so far
uh-huh.
that it would have to, you know, have some substantial changes in order to fit in an altar rail.
But
that would be one example.
But you could, a pastor could, physically it's possible, you could have the altar rail.
Yeah, it's not legally prohibited.
Yeah. It's one of those things that's probably inflames passions more than you would want to, though. I mean, I think there's still some like residual.
Well, there are some parishes that have them, not many in this country, but there are some.
Okay. Not at St. Anonymous.
This was another thing. For a period of time, there was a big push to, we've just got to change everything.
Yeah.
And these things then became tribal markers of
yes.
are you in the hip yeah. tribe or are you in the unhip tribe?
Yeah, right.
And really, these things don't matter to yeah. God. You
right.
know, whether do you have a rail or not? The important thing is you're receiving communion.
Yeah.
Do you receive standing or not? The important thing is you're receiving.
Yeah.
And so the others are things that we can have different opinions about, and they may foster our personal spirituality in
yeah.
one way or another that varies from person to person, but we shouldn't be looking down on each other and dividing up into tribes. One of the things that St. Paul is always talking about in his epistles, be of one mind.
Yes.
Don't
right.
be at peace with other Christians. Do not get into these tribal hangups.
Yeah. Thanks, Jimmy. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Can we be happy without God? Atheists say yes. We Christians say yes, but only to a certain extent. What's our reason? There are some natural human desires that can be satisfied without living for God. The desire for sensory pleasure, success, and loving relationships. There are certain desires, however, that can't be satisfied without God. For example, we don't just desire some love, we desire infinite love, love without limit. This is manifest when we get frustrated with imperfect manifestations of it. The same is true for knowledge, justice, and beauty. Since God alone is infinite in these perfections, only He can satisfy our desires for them. Therefore, to borrow from St. Augustine, without God, our hearts would be forever restless. And my friends, a restless heart is an unhappy heart. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
This is apologist Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day. In conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. To that end, My good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a go-to resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Our topic, whatever is on your mind or in your craw about the Catholic Church. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, about morals, ethics, all those are welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. And we go now to Joseph in Springfield, Minnesota, listening on Catholic.com. Joseph, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I was wondering, I kind of have a two-part question.
Okay.
I was talking with a friend about Catholic evangelization,
mm-hmm.
and the recent readings about that talk about the early Christian community being of one heart and one mind,
mm-hmm.
Have kind of been on my heart. And I was thinking also about like John 17, Jesus's prayer for the unity of Christians. And I was expressing my desire to this friend for like the reunification of Catholics and Protestants.
Right.
And my friend expressed or said like, well, you know, you could unite them, but like you could never like completely unite them. And so my question is, like, after 500 years of, like, the Protestant Reformation, is it possible at this point for, like, a complete reunification, or is that just a natural consequence of the Reformation that there will always be this divide?
So ultimately, there will be full Christian unity at the Second Coming and in the next life. We're not going to have these distinctions at that point. It's just going to be followers of Christ. So there will be Christian reunification in that sense. But in terms of what's realistic in this life, it seems to me that Christian unification can be promoted in a number of ways. One is by talking about promoting what forms of unity are possible without a complete acceptance of all of the same points of theology. For example, since Roe v. Wade here in the United States, Protestants and Catholics have been working together on pro-life issues, and that's led them to get closer together. And it's even led them to reconsider some things that previously divided them. And there's been some movement to where Protestants have viewed Catholics, including Catholic doctrines, more favorably than they did previously, and the reverse is true as well. So there's been a kind of practical Christian unity as a result of social forces like the need to combat abortion, and that's been a form of Christian unity that has come about in the last 50 years, but it's still shy of full visible ecclesial communion. So what are the possibilities for full visible ecclesial communion? Well, there have been some reunifications with Protestants in that area as well. I'm an example. I'm a convert from Protestantism. That was a form on the micro level of Christian reunification. There have even been some collective reunifications where an individual Protestant congregation has entered the Catholic Church, or groups of Protestant congregations, like with the Anglican Ordinariate Ordinariates that began to be created during the tenure of Pope Benedict. So you can have situations where groups of Protestants reunify with the Catholic Church. In terms of what there may be in the future in that regard, well, there may be some some reunifications of a group corporate nature that involve full visible communion. We'll have to wait and see. It might take hundreds of years for some of those to happen. I know there's been talk about it. After the Second Vatican Council, for example, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he wasn't a cardinal yet, but Cardinal Ratzinger, or later Pope Benedict, was engaged in some discussions concerning Lutherans who were interested in reuniting in a corporate manner with the Catholic Church. And there was some consideration given to, well, okay, to what degree are Lutheran confessions of faith, like the Augsburg Confession, compatible with Catholic teaching? And are there ways that Lutherans and Catholics could be in full visible unity, provided we're on the same page in terms of how we understand various things, and they could retain certain elements of their Lutheran heritage the same way that people in the Anglican ordinariates retain elements of their Anglican heritage? And those discussions didn't end up producing concrete results in terms of corporate reunions, but the fact that the discussions happened is a signal of what's possible. And given a few hundred years, there could be further similar discussions that one day might bear fruit. Having said all that, the division that the Protestant Reformation caused went much deeper and in so many more directions than previous divisions had. There are divisions between Catholics, for example, and Eastern Orthodox, or Catholics and the Assyrian Church of the East, or Catholics and Coptic Christians. But those differences are much smaller and much more easy in the abstract to overcome than what happened with Protestantism, where it fragmented and went in bunches of different directions and deviated from historic Christian understandings of things much more than any of the previous divisions had. And I don't see a practical way to establish large-scale corporate reunion anytime in the near future with the Protestant community as a whole. I don't think that's probably practical before the Second Coming. You might, in hundreds of years' time, have some major chunks be able to have restored full unity. But I think the dominant note in terms of engaging in promoting Christian unity with the Protestant community is going to be more in terms of practical unity rather than full ecclesiastical communion.
Joseph, thanks so much for that question. I very much appreciate it. 888-318-7884 is our number. We go to Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin. And Ryan, let me just give you a little warning. We're not far from a break, so if you can phrase it as quickly as you can, well, maybe we can get the answer in before the break.
All right, that's fine. But my question is, if laws in the United Kingdom, Norway, Denmark, and Sweden were to be changed to allow present or future monarchs to become Catholics, mm-hmm. how would their conversions be handled? Would they be instructed all under one bishop? Would they be instructed by individual bishops or something like that? I ask this because if the British converted, how would this affect the marriage of Prince Charles to his current wife, Camilla, given the circumstances of his previous marriage?
Okay. Well, my sense is that conversions of royals who wanted to become Catholic and who were monarchs or who were likely to become monarchs would be handled on an ad hoc basis. The church would want to do whatever it could to facilitate their conversion, and so probably they'd be allowed to pick who they wanted to take instruction from. It might just be an ordinary priest, not even a bishop. Now, obviously, there would be consultation of the local bishop and of the national hierarchy. So in the case of a British monarch converting, the chief ecclesiastical officer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, I guess, would end up being consulted. But he might not be the one to perform instruction or to receive the monarch into the church. That would be a matter that would be determined on an ad hoc basis. In terms of Prince Charles, I'm not aware of him wanting to convert, but if he wanted to, since he's a widower He would not need an annulment. There undoubtedly would be some premarital counseling involved, but he's a widower. I don't know about Camilla Parker Bowles. I don't know.
I'm sorry,
Jimmy. Whether she's a widow or whether she's divorced. If she's divorced and her previous spouse is still living, then she would need an annulment. And there, and depending on the results of that, they might need a convalidation. But but in principle, it would be handled the same way you handle it for ordinary people, just because British monarchs would be involved with a great deal of discretion.
Thanks very much for that question, Ryan. I had never thought about that. Would a British monarch get to still be the monarch, though, if they've
converted themselves? Well, that's what Ryan was asking about. They'd have to change the law in England to allow a Catholic to continue to serve as monarch.
I see. We'd welcome in the church, but they may not be able to stay as monarch.
Unless the civil law changes. I suspect that law is going to go away before too long.
All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
In Ireland right now, we are facing a serious crisis. The agents of the culture of death are attempting to have abortion legalized in our country. We cannot allow this to happen. In these moments, we are asking the EWTN family to join with us in prayer.
To join in prayer and to find out how you can help the pro-life movement in Ireland, go to EWTN in Ireland at ewtn.ie.
The world is changing. The days of picking up a paperback book or popping a DVD or compact disc in the player have given way to the digital age. The good news is that the shop at Catholic.com has joined the digital revolution. Check out the new digital platform at shop.catholic.com, where all of our DVDs, books, and audio products are now available in digital form for you to purchase and download at your convenience, anywhere you go. For that matter, anywhere in the world. We've got hundreds of offerings, so visit shop.catholic.com today and check out our selection. That's shop.catholic.com.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information and discourse on crucial issues, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. And as a special bonus, if you order online, we'll add an ebook copy of 15 Myths, Mistakes, and Misrepresentations About the Deuterocanon to your order absolutely free. Get your free ebook today. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by logging on to our online shop at shop.catholic.com.
Welcome back. It's Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum today. 2 hours of Open Forum. So if you have a question, we still got plenty of time to get to your question. Now, don't think that it's over. There's plenty of time. Just call 888-318-7884. And I want to keep repeating that invitation is open to anyone, whether you are Catholic or not. Also, before we get going again here in the second half of this hour, I want to remind you that The Dawn of Christian History, Jimmy's new DVD, Unveiling the Story of the Early Church, is available with no shipping charge at all at shop.catholic.com. No shipping charge. Just go to shop.catholic.com. If you have any interest at all.
No shipping charge is another way of saying free shipping.
Yes, that is a very excellent point. But yours is more succinct than mine was. That's why,
More attractive.
You make DVDs.
I'd much rather like to order something that has free shipping than something that has no shipping charge.
Thank you, Jim, for clarifying that. I'm sure you will probably get dozens of life points for making that point. You know what I'm talking about?
Thank you.
So that you can go to the good.
Dozens. what number would you put on it specifically?
I think probably 36.
36. So 36. 3 dozen. That's great.
Yeah.
I can use all the points I can get if I'm going to get into the good place.
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. And we have a guest in the studio.
Yeah.
We'd love it. First of all, we love it when you come by and visit us at Catholic Answers. And if you're ever in San Diego and you want to do so, make sure you just send an email. and set it up with someone. We'll give you the tour. And if I have any snacks in my office at the time, I'll share my snacks with you. But Judy is here with us right now. Judy, thanks for coming in.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Judy, you are from?
I am from Lakeside, California.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, I call square dances in Lakeside.
Yeah, I'd like to. At the convention you're having, I'm thinking that would be fun.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah, the square dancing. And sign up early, though, so you can get the Jimmy Akin M&Ms.
Oh, right, yeah.
I've heard about that. Okay, good.
Judy, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a long one. I'm just going to read what I wrote down.
Okay.
I know the teaching of the church is that Mary was conceived sinless. And of that means it was preordained, predestined. But then it is also said that Mary had a choice, and she said yes when the angel Gabriel told her she would conceive. So my confusion is, was she predestined to be chosen, or was it her free will yes?
So there's ultimately – now, the term predestined can mean a number of different things. But ultimately, there's no conflict between something being predestined and something being the product of free will, because God, in his knowledge of what happens in history, is outside of time. And so he can see – the free choices that people make and incorporate those free choices into his plan. Mm-hmm. And so when he does that, it's called we use the term predestined for those things because God foresaw this person's going to do this and he used it in his plan, and thus from that point of view, he predestined it. Now, the term predestined can be used other ways, in ways that would exclude free will. But when the church uses the term, it uses it in a way that incorporates free will. And in fact, if you look in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, where it talks about the predestination of Mary, mm-hmm. if memory serves, it actually mentions God's ability in that passage to incorporate the free will responses of creatures into his plan when it's explaining the predestination of Mary. And so what happened from this point of view is God, outside of time, seeing all of history at once, makes the offer to Mary to become the mother of his son. He sees her free acceptance of it, and that gets incorporated into his overall plan, which, coming from outside of time, means that that was always going to happen. If you're living in, say, the age of Moses, 1200 BC or whatever, then that all lay in the future. And from Moses's perspective, you would see it as predestined because it's already taken up into God's plan. That is going to happen. But nevertheless, it incorporates Mary's free choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Like a foreknowledge.
Yes. Like foreknowledge.
Okay. Understand. Thank you.
No problem.
Hey,
thank you for joining us.
Thanks for coming in, Judy. Sorry, I don't have any snacks. I apologize for that.
I know. We don't have any here. The little snack tray is empty.
I got nothing. Let's go to Augustine in Sacramento, California. Augustine, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
My question is, what will happen to us? Okay, first of all, I have a two-part question.
Okay.
My first question is, what will happen to us? And what will Jesus do when he comes back to earth?
Okay. When Jesus comes back to earth, he will solve all of the world's problems. And the world is going to have problems. It has problems now, and it's going to have problems then, too. In fact, it's likely to have some pretty bad problems right when Jesus comes back. But when Jesus comes back, he's going to solve all of those problems, and he's going to raise the dead. So all of the dead people who have ever lived will come back to life, and he will take all of those people who have been friends of God, either people who are still alive or people who have just come back to life. He'll take all of those people who are friends of God to be in God's kingdom. He's going to change the earth and make it much better, so that Scripture refers to it as a new earth with a new heaven. It's going to be great. And all God's friends will get to live there. And then the people who chose not to be with God God will not force them to be with him. So he'll let them go to their own place, and it won't be pleasant because they've cut themselves off from God, who's the source of everything good, but he's going to still respect the choice they made and not force himself on them.
Does that clear it up for you, Augustine?
Yes.
Okay, what's your second question?
My second question is, if that happens, if you are not baptized, will you still get to go to heaven when Jesus comes down to earth?
It depends on whether you've been a friend of God. If you didn't know, for example, that you needed to be baptized, but you otherwise wanted to do what God wants you to do, so that, you know, if you knew that he wants you to be baptized, well, of course, if you say, well, of course I'd get baptized if I knew God wanted me to, well, then you're acting like a friend of God and you'll get to go to heaven even though you weren't baptized in this life. On the other hand, if you knew that you're supposed to be baptized and you said, I don't care if God wants that, I'm not getting baptized, I'm not going to do what I need to do to be a Christian, I'm going to do my own thing, well, then you're not being a friend of God and so you wouldn't go to heaven.
Augustine, thank you for that question. You sound young, Augustine. Are you in college or
maybe grad school?
No, I'm in second grade.
Second awesome. Grade. That's cool. Does that mean you make your first communion this year, Augustine, in second grade?
No, actually, I'm not even baptized yet.
Oh, oh well, okay. I shouldn't have assumed. I apologize, Augustine. But thank you for your questions. And call back anytime, okay?
Please do.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. I like Augustine. He just asked the question, man.
Yeah,
he just lays it on
you. I love talking to kids because kids do not – one of the things we sometimes talk about is a lot of people, adults, feel the need to give us all the backstory to how a question arose to justify why they're asking it. It's like, you don't need to. That's
okay.
What we're here for.
Just, right.
Just kids don't do that. They just – here's my question, and it's so awesome.
Well, I have a question for you, Jimmy. One time, my uncle and I, we were out in a boat.
What's your question?
Then when we were in the boat, we developed.
What's your question?
No, I'm getting there. All right, moving on. Sorry, just Jimmy and I being smart Alex.
Radio smart Alex.
Victor in Greenville, North Carolina, watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube. Victor, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
So is there really a difference between an atheist and agnostic atheist?
Well, it's not a term. Agnostic atheist is not a term that one normally encounters. I mean, the basic meanings of the terms, an atheist is a person who doesn't believe in God or the gods, and an agnostic is a person who doesn't know whether God or the gods exist. And so those are the normal meanings of the terms. Now, sometimes you'll see them kind of grouped together. And so one might hear about like someone who is agnostic slash atheist or atheist slash agnostic or a group of people who fall into that category. And that would mean they're kind of one or the other, or it's not clear what their views are, or maybe they go back and forth between the two views. Like some days they say, I don't know, and other days they say, no, I'm pretty sure there's not. So that's a way in that kind of slash sense of the terms where they're kind of combined that I could see that term making sense, that combined term. There may be other ways that people use it. I can imagine some that someone might say, well, I'm an agnostic atheist, meaning I'm an agnostic, but I function as an atheist. So even though technically I don't know whether God exists, I act for practical purposes and I assume that God doesn't exist. So even though I don't claim to know that God doesn't exist, and I could imagine somebody saying that. In fact, I know of people who do say things like that. In fact, Stephen Hawking, if I'm not mistaken, the recently deceased physicist, would sometimes say things like that. And I certainly know other people do. But that usage hasn't given rise to a common expression of an agnostic atheist. That's still not a common term. And so anyone who would use that expression, I think, would need to explain it a little bit, what they mean by it, because it's not an established usage. They need to explain what they mean by it in order for to guarantee that their audience would understand what they mean.
Okay, Victor?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it was just confusing me because I was trying to look up the terms. I couldn't really understand, but thank you.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you very much, Victor. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
Today, countless people have drifted away from their faith. You know the story. Faithful parents and grandparents see their children and grandchildren drift away from the church. At first, they just stop going regularly, but they still consider themselves Christian. Then, later, they or their children stop even thinking of themselves as Christian. Eventually, some of them turn bitter and hostile to religion. This sorrowful sequence has played itself out over and over, literally millions of times. Perhaps it's even played out in your own family. The good news is that there's hope. That's why Catholic Answers is releasing a new book by apologist Matt Nelson. It's called Just Whatever: How to Help the Spiritually Indifferent Find Beliefs That Really Matter. The book is designed to help people without firm Catholic beliefs, regardless of where they're coming from. They may only identify as Christians in a kind of nebulous way. They may say that they're spiritual, but opposed to organized religion. Or they may be hostile to religion altogether. Whatever their current views, Matt's new book contains winning, persuasive means for helping them get past their current difficulties and see just how important it is to have a life-transforming encounter with God. To make your donation and get a free copy of Just Whatever, visit Catholic.com and click the Just Whatever banner, or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the Just Whatever banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Yes, it is Catholic Answers Live. Welcome back. We're happy to have you with us. Open Forum this hour. Oh, next hour, Open Forum as well. So it's 2 hours of any question that you have about the Catholic faith, about Catholic people, about ethics, morals, philosophy. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, did I mention this already? Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and he has a brand new DVD out called The Dawn of Christian History. And you can get that at shop.catholic.com. We go now to Michael in Lafayette, Indiana, watching on Facebook. Michael, thanks for watching on Facebook. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I think it was St. Irenaeus who said the glory of God is a human being fully alive. And to me, part of what means being fully alive is having a sense of humor,
uh-huh.
like our wonderful host, Cy Kellett.
Oh, thanks, Michael. So,
you're very
yeah,
welcome.
I'm still working on that one.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, does our Catholic tradition say anything in particular about the value of sense of humor, and are there any places in the Bible where humor is especially prominent?
Well, so Catholic tradition certainly recognizes the value of humor because humor is a human universal. It's something that's built into human nature. It's related to the play instinct, and the play instinct is something that God built in not just to our species, but he built it into other species too. So you see like dogs playing with each other, and they love playing. And you see cats playing with each other, especially kittens. They love playing. Humans love playing, especially kids. And one of the reasons for that, and one of the reasons that play is especially common in the young of a species, is because it gets them to engage in situations like if you watch dogs playing or kittens playing, they're like kind of wrestling with each other. Well, they're doing an activity. They're simulating an activity that they will need to engage in as adults but they're doing it in a kind of safe way. So they're just play fighting. They're not really fighting until, of course, someone gets bitten too hard. But they're play fighting as a way of getting them used to something they're going to need to do as an adult. They're going to need to be able to handle threatening, dangerous situations. And so to get them ready for that, they have an instinct to engage in simulations of those early. And in order to get them motivated to engage in those simulations, it has to be fun. And so there's a natural fun that they experience and we experience when we engage in simulated danger situations. Now, humans, because we're humans, take this to a whole different level than any other species. And we do the same thing in much more abstract ways. But one of the ways that humans do it, that humans engage in play, is with drama. And that's the impulse of fiction. All fiction comes from this same thing. It's simulated dramatic situations to get us ready for real life drama. And it's fun so that we'll engage in fiction. Same thing with humor. Humor involves some kind of simulated drama or danger. If there's nothing like that, if there's no drama in the humor, it's not funny. And so we also, with that, need to find it enjoyable. And so it's all related to this play instinct. And laughter in particular is something that's directly built into human nature. It's apparently related to a chimpanzee behavior known as the pant-pant reflex, where chimps, when they're playing, will make this panting noise that sounds kind of like laughter. But it's also hardwired into humans. And I have a personal favorite example of that, because one of the families I've been very close to has a daughter who was born deaf. And I would be over at their house, and I would be watching the kids play, and I would be seeing this, you know, 5-year-old little girl who has never heard in her life running around laughing her head off playing with the other kids.
Oh, yes.
And so laughter is directly built into human nature, and humor is directly built into human nature. And it's part of this larger play instinct. So, of course, Catholic tradition embraces humor, and there will be, you know, any number of passages where it gets discussed. There are passages in the Bible that talk about it. Sometimes the image of laughter is used. Now, humor can have more than one aspect. It can have the playful aspect, but it can also have a kind of – there's a kind of darker humor as well, where you can ridicule things as a way of putting them in their place. And so it can serve as a kind of commentary on those things. And we find both in Scripture. We find celebrations of mirth. And, you know, like if memory serves, like some of the wisdom books like Proverbs talk about that. Jesus uses the image of laughter when he talks about – in one of the parables where he talks about how there's rejoicing in heaven upon the conversion of a sinner. Well, some people have translated that there's laughter in heaven among the angels. The angels are like up there cheering and laughing when a sinner repents.
Yeah.
Then there are also illustrations of the kind of darker humor, the darker use of humor to provide social commentary on negative things that need to be criticized. And Jesus also does that exactly, because he will talk about the blind leading the blind. Okay,
right.
That's sarcasm.
Yeah.
You know, the image of a blind person leading another blind person, taking on the role of a sighted person, that's funny. That has humor embedded in it.
Yeah.
But it's the darker use of humor to provide commentary on things that need criticism, like hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And so there are a variety of different appearances of the concept of humor. Also, there's like God scoffs at the people who are, you know, putting their plans against him and stuff. Well, scoffing is a form of laughter. It's a form of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So the image of humor in all its kind of human richness does get used there, even in the Old Testament, what are known as taunt songs. Taunt songs were a custom that Middle Eastern cultures would use and still use to taunt their opponents as a kind of commentary on their relationship and the problems in their relationship. And a modern equivalent of that is a rap battle. And so if you see like performers from different rap groups or rap artists, you know, doing this kind of insult trading in a poetic form, that's essentially a modern version of the ancient taunt song. Uh-huh. And some of the prophets contain taunt songs against the enemies of the people of God. Uh-huh. And so humor gets used in those as well. There's a famous one where I want to say it's where Sisera's mother her son is being mocked, and they have a taunt song involving it's in the Book of Judges, where the opponent of the people of God, Sisera, has actually been killed, and they're imagining his people don't know that, and so they're imagining how they assume the mighty Sisera is just going to bring back all this booty, and mom is imagining, oh, and he's going to bring a pretty shawl for me to wear and stuff like that. And what they don't know is God's judgment has already fallen on Sisera, uh-huh. and he's not bringing a shawl back for Mama.
Right.
But that's an example of the darker use of humor in Scripture, but we also have the lighter use as well, because that's also part of the human experience.
That was a fascinating question, Michael. What do you think of that answer?
I think that that reminded me of situational irony at the very end there. And I appreciate that when I see Jesus telling off the Pharisees.
Oh, awesome. Oh, by the way, I meant to mention there's a book by Eldon Trueblood called The Humor of Christ that you might want to check out.
Michael, thanks very much for that. Jimmy, is there any in many ways, humor is a cultural artifact. It fits in its time and place.
It's like language.
Yeah. So when we read the Bible, is it possible that there might be things in there that would have been funny in their time?
Oh, absolutely.
But we just don't get it.
Absolutely. And there are also conversely things that were not funny then that would be funny now.
Oh.
If we translated them literally, but we don't.
Yeah.
For example, did you know God has a long nose?
No.
There are Old Testament passages where it praises God for being long of nose. Now, today, if you translated that literally, it would sound hilarious.
Yeah,
you know, oh man, he's awesome. God is so long of nose. Well, long of nose in Hebrew is an idiom meaning patient. So patient people who don't get easily riled and who are tolerant and forgiving, patient people are said to be long of nose.
Michael, again, thank you for that question. Our number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If you have a question about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not, give us a call. We're happy to take it because we've got another hour coming up. Do you think we can get to one more before we have to go to a break?
Let's try.
All right, let's give it a shot. Let's see how we can do. Vito, can you state your question quickly for Jimmy?
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'll make my question quick.
Thank you.
My question is, what are the differences between the word spirit and soul that we know of as Catholic? Okay.
The terms are used in substantially the same sense, and they both refer to the immaterial spiritual or immaterial non-physical part of a person. They are sometimes distinguished from each other in the New Testament, but there the Greek terms are psuche and pneumatos, and psuche can also be translated life, for example, whereas pneumatos can also be translated wind or breath, mm-hmm. and so they have different connotations. And sometimes the two terms are used, but to my mind, the way they're used suggests it's really they almost totally overlap, and it's really hard to specify a concrete distinction from them. So I tend to look at them as involving synonymous parallelism, even when they're both used together. They're really just different ways of referring to the same thing, even though the notions connected with them, like life or wind, are somewhat different.
Vito, you are very generous to ask your question so quickly. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jimmy Akin. Thank you again for another fine hour. I say maybe another 70 or 80 life points.
Oh, thank you. And I was gonna give you, you know, like plus 88 for hosting this.
Plus 88. Awesome. Wow. Yeah. I am really doing well. The Dawn of Christian History is the new DVD from Jimmy, unveiling the story of the early church. Get it now at shop.catholic.com. And in addition to no shipping charge, it's free shipping. We'll be right back with more Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.